It's personal.
Okay, that might be a little dated, the theme music from The Dating Game, but The Dating Game has changed. By 2010, a third of America's 90 million singles had online dating profiles in at least one or more of the growing number of online dating sites. Singleton journalist Dan Slater couldn't escape the subject. Wherever he went, friends, acquaintances, strangers alike were talking about their profiles and their online site of choice. When he couldn't beat it, he eventually joined it, and since then has written a book about the history of online dating and how it has changed not only how we meet, but also how we mate. Dan Slater is with us by phone today from New York City to talk about his new book, Love in the Time of Algorithms. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Question for our listeners first. Have you used an online dating service? Are you one of the 30 million singles out there? Tell us how it has worked for you. Maybe you're not single anymore because of it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. I think in your introduction, Dan, it was interesting when you described how you learned that your own parents had met online themselves all the way back in the 1960s. And I wondered, how did that even work back then?
Well, it worked without an online world. There was no online, but there you did have a computer, this thing called the Honeywell 200, which is this enormous machine that was probably about the size of your studio there. And you'd fill out a questionnaire that was actually on a piece of paper, and you'd return the questionnaire with your $3 or $4 subscription fee, and then you know, the answers would get switched on to something like a punch card, which is like a voting card. And that would get slid through this enormous machine, and then it would spit out five or six matches, which would then get sent to you in the mail. And so you'd have the phone number of the person or the address of the person, and it was up to you to reach out without the benefit of the text message or something like that.
Were the algorithms, the methods of spitting out those matches, essentially the same then as they are now?
Same in theory, but much more rudimentary, I think, in the amount of information they were able to collate. So back then, first of all, you know, the computer dating world in the 60s was limited mostly to colleges. So everyone was, you know, who was doing it was between maybe 18 and 22. And so after you had sorted your pools based on age and the school you went to, you know, the geographic area, you were sort of already so delimited that you couldn't really get to more of the sort of the probing questions.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And right now I'm talking with Dan Slater, a journalist and the author of Love in the Time of Algorithms, What Technology Does to Meeting and Mating. If you have a question or comment for Dan, I would love to know if you've met your true love online or not. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post your questions or comments there. Unlike people who have started some of the most successful online dating sites ever, I thought this was kind of funny, Dan. You actually used online dating and found some satisfaction with the process. But first, let's talk about the people who have developed these sites. They aren't necessarily into love.
Well, no. In fact, some of the most successful were already married before they got into the industry, and which I think, you know, it tells you something that these sort of math geeks seem to be the ones who might be the most successful at running an online dating site. It may mean that you don't necessarily need a philosophy of love or an approach, you know, to love, or you don't need to be single. You just need to know how to set up a site in a logical way, and you need to know the math, and you need to know the computer science behind it. Which may not be, it may not sound too romantic to some of your listeners.
No, and you've met them. You've interviewed them.
Sure.
What are these guys like?
They're very smart. They're very smart guys. And you know, I think the thing they're focused on most is efficiency. They want their site obviously to work well for their users, and that efficiency will mean different things depending on which industry executive you're speaking with. Some may look at that efficiency from more of a relationship standpoint. some may look at it from more of a math and numbers standpoint.
So you did use online dating. You stopped. Why did you start and why did you stop?
Well, I started for a couple reasons. I had been in a long-term relationship, and I also had a job at a newspaper, and I lost both of those things at around the same time. So I was about 31 years old, and I was now a freelance writer working out of my apartment, and you know, my social circle or my social opportunities, whatever you want to call them, had become highly limited all of a sudden in a way that I was not used to. And it was 2009, which I think was the year that it was around the time that a lot of online dating sites were beginning to become very, very popular. And, you know, they had obviously been around for much longer, but that was around the time that I think the stigma had really begun to sort of erode. And so I approached it, I think, for the same reason that a lot of people do. It's, you know, maybe you had a negative opinion of it for a while, but then you get to a point where you say, well, hey, there's nothing to lose. Why not just give this a shot? So that's what led me into it. And I did it for a while. I was on Match.com for about 4 or 5 months. I actually met a delightful person. We had a relationship for about a year. And when that ended, that was around the time that I started to work on the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of made a pact with myself that I would not do online dating while I was working on the book because I wanted it to be a reported book. I did not want it to be influenced by my own opinions, even though it obviously is to some extent. But I wanted to force myself to really get out there and meet as many online dating users as I could. So that was the reason I stopped. And I also actually ended up meeting somebody in a yoga class. So.
which was on, I think you mentioned Facebook.
Well, so what happened actually, this was another reason that I got an online dating, which I guess I conveniently forgot, was that I had asked out my yoga instructor. And she said no, because she had a boyfriend. And so that was another, I said, oh gosh, you know, the offline thing really isn't working for me. So that was sort of another reason. So anyway, a couple of years passed and I was on Facebook one day and the yoga instructor popped up in that right-hand column of the people you may know. I guess we had a friend in common or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that was how we had used, you know, so we did use technology to reconnect, although it was not sort of online dating.
So you ended up with the person that you had perceived in real life to be a good match.
Funny how it worked out. Yeah.
It's just quicker, so I guess. I mean, so what is the point? You know, the premise, or I don't know if it's a premise of your book per se, but it's a theme in your book that not that online dating sites merely change how we find a date, but it also changes how we perceive relationships in general.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
How so?
And for sure. I think it gets back to that efficiency point that we referenced earlier. You know, what my reporting showed, both from the side of the, you know, all the industry executives that I spoke with and also all the users I spoke with, was that it's not so much about the site you're on per se. It's not so much about eHarmony versus Match.com versus OkCupid versus something else. It's more about just the fact of this new technology in our lives and what it has done for the efficiency of meeting new people. And I think that efficiency, both in terms of finding new people online and then also all the information about them that we can now access, I think that is having big, big impacts on the way that we perceive our relationship lives. And that's a lot of what the book is about.
Well, let's hear from Amanda first. Amanda in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You used online successfully.
Yes. Yeah, I met my husband online. We've been together for 3 years now, been married for 1 year.
Was that what you got into online dating for, was to meet a life partner?
Not at the time, no. That's not what my intentions necessarily were, but it definitely grew into that.
Dan Slater, is that more typical now? Are people looking for partners or not, like Amanda started out not necessarily just looking for dates?
Well, the one thing to remember with online dating, you know, a lot of people will ask me, they'll say, so what sort of person does online dating, or what are the kinds of folks you meet when you talk to all these online daters? And the one thing about, you know, online dating users is that so many people are doing it now. I mean, you know, you said earlier, a third of the 90 million singles in the country have an online dating profile. So when you get out there and talk to these people, what you find is the whole gamut of intentions, obviously male, female, up and down the age and ethnicity spectrums. So there isn't any necessarily any one kind of person. There are a lot of people looking for relationships. There are a lot of people looking for something else. And there are a lot of people, I think, like our caller, who start off not necessarily having a specific intention, just wanting to meet people. And maybe, I guess this is sort of the utopian ideal of online dating, but maybe what online dating does for a lot of people is that it gives them a number of experiences and allows them to get to a point where they say, okay, now I am ready to meet someone. Now I am ready to settle down.
Amanda, is that what happened with you?
Yeah, I would say pretty much.
Did you ever meet anybody online that you ended up just becoming friends with?
No, because it was weird. After, you know, you have the intentions of dating, and then, you know, it didn't quite work out. It wasn't, and it was mainly on my end, so ending it was a difficult. I'm not very good at that, I guess, so it was always a little awkward.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Amanda.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Thanks.
See you, Amanda. Bye.
Bye.
Dan, you have had in your experience what is referred to by psychologists as a frictionless market. What do you mean by that?
I use that term. I use frictionless.
okay.
So actually, somebody else, was not a term that I invented, although I use it a few times in the book, but it's a frictionless market is essentially a market that results when you take away the barriers to meeting the kinds of people in your demographic, in your geographic area who you might like. So obviously before online dating came along, there was a fair amount of friction, right? I mean, you might live in an apartment building that was right next door to your soulmate. Mm-hmm. And maybe just as luck would have it, you never meet that person because you leave the building 5 minutes away from each other every morning, and you return at different times or something. What online dating has done is to break down a lot of those barriers that have existed for so long. And so that's what psychologists mean when they say that, you know, our markets have become frictionless. Obviously, they haven't become completely frictionless, but I think that one of the revolutionary things online dating has done is to remove so many of those barriers.
I'm talking with Dan Slater. He's a journalist and the author of Love in the Time of Algorithms. We'll continue our conversation about online dating when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Oscar-nominated Zero Dark Thirty opens with a declaration that the story is based on firsthand accounts of actual events. But Senators Dianne Feinstein and John McCain say the film got it seriously wrong when it showed suspects giving up information under torture. I'm Neil Conan, Zero Dark Thirty, Osama bin Laden, and the new debate on torture. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4, and it's 34 degrees in downtown Columbus. Increasing clouds today, a slight chance of rain, a high of 45. Clouds tonight, a low of 28. A little bit of snow for Friday, less than half an inch, a high of 38. Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the work of dynamic Japanese dance artist Hiroki Umide in the Capitol Theater at the Rife Center for one night only on February 19th. Tickets and details at wexarts.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Dan Slater. He's a journalist and the author of Love in the Time of Algorithms, What Technology Does to Meeting and Mating. Dan, you mentioned the stigma associated with computer dating, then online dating. What happened? When did that change? You said 2009 was a big year. Why? Just because another generation had come into play and they didn't have the stigma anymore? How did that work?
I think there were a lot of factors in society that helped overcome the stigma of online dating. One of them was obviously that it seemed to be working for a lot of people. And I think once you try something and it works for you, then you become perhaps a sort of evangelist on its behalf, or at least you no longer denigrate it, or at least you can no longer afford to have the stigma. So I think there were more and more people every day who could no longer afford to have the stigma.
And you mentioned, too, social media has exploded in recent years since, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009. And that's put something of a dent into the online dating industry. Is it because of sort of the experience you had, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that... you know, I think that obviously if you just think about what online dating is, it's really just a vertical within the larger world of social media. It, you know, it happens to be a paid vertical. At least most of the sites out there you have to pay for. There are very many free ones. And so I think that people also feel a little more comfortable sometimes on a social media site like Facebook than they do on an online dating site, because it's just more casual. You don't have to, there isn't any pressure. And also, you think about the difference between an online dating site and something like Facebook. On Facebook, everyone has their real information there. There's no sort of avatar. You don't have a screen name. Use your real name on Facebook. And it's also, you know, you can see who someone's friends are, see, you know, the company they keep. And I think a lot of people just feel that that's a little bit more natural than sort of the old online dating model. So this has definitely been putting a dent into, you know, the revenues and, you know, the online dating space.
As we were talking about earlier, a third of America's 90 million singles by 2010 had online dating profiles in at least one or more of the growing number of online dating sites. And some entrepreneurs have tapped into niche markets of online dating. Others have become cartographers of online dating. Still with us, Dan Slater, author of Love in the Time of Algorithms. Joining us now is Lori Davis. She's founder of eFlirt Expert. It's an online dating consultancy. She's also the author of Love at First Click, The Ultimate Guide to Online Dating. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. You've said that the term online dating is kind of a misnomer. Why is that?
Well, really, it's online meeting and offline dating. You're not actually dating online. You may be courting each other online after the fact and before the fact, but really, the relationship develops face-to-face.
You know, I was thinking about that movie. I don't know if you guys were born yet. You've Got Mail, the Meg Ryan vehicle. And they didn't, it was just a chat room they met in. They didn't know each other, and they courted each other without knowing who each other was. But I wondered, to what extent do people communicate in advance of meeting more or less online? Is that more popular now or less popular? What's the recommended amount, Lori?
Conversations are definitely shorter than they used to be before you meet. I actually put up my first online dating profile in 2001, so I've watched the evolution and been part of it as well. And, you know, I used to have these very long conversations with people and talk on the phone multiple times before we meet, and now it's a quicker exchange. I suggest about 6 emails before you get offline.
And talking on the phone, too?
Actually, you can skip the phone. ultimately, it's about the chemistry that you're going to have face-to-face. You've already communicated a little. You already know you have similar values, similar interests. Chemistry is really the missing piece. So the sooner you can get in person, the better.
I would say the phone is really important because it helps you weed out all the people who, you know, you aren't, you know, who you won't have the chemistry with. I mean, Once you're on the phone with them, if you can have a conversation on the phone, you can meet. But if it's kind of dead on the phone, it's definitely not, you know, going to work out.
Well, have you ever gone ahead and met somebody anyways, Dan, that you didn't click with on the phone but found they were a little bit better in person? I don't know.
I'm sure that that happens, but I just feel like you can tell so much from a phone conversation. And, you know, especially as you're meeting so many people now online, there needs to be some way to narrow it down, I think, at least for a lot of people. I just feel like the phone is a pretty good way to do that.
Lori Davis?
Yeah. The only problem with the phone, though, is that it can give a faux sense of familiarity. And you might still have a great phone conversation, but not click well offline. And then especially in today's busy society, it becomes yet another thing to schedule. So it's, you know, your schedules have to line up in order for you to chat. And sometimes it can become a hurdle that you have to overcome in order to meet.
You, Lori, didn't start an online dating site. You founded a company that helps people navigate these sites. How did you figure out that this was not just necessary, but something you could actually make a living at?
Well, I got the inspiration one day when one of my friends called and told me that he was moving in with his girlfriend. And I realized that I helped him meet her online. And in fact, I had lots of friends who I had been helping over the years since, like I mentioned, I was an early adopter. And it's kind of circumstance for me also in that I was in marketing and I worked for Fortune 500, but I was a consultant. And during the recession, I lost nearly all of my clients. In fact, one of my clients was invested with Bernie Madoff. so I was struggling. And then I realized that I had this unique talent and started my business. 2 days later, with just $50 and a Twitter account. And a lot of people thought I was crazy, but I knew that, you know, this was a unique skill, helping people navigate dating sites, and that it was needed because online dating is becoming more and more popular every day.
Dance Leader, what is your sense or what did you find about how the online dating sites or meeting sites have evolved over time to, attract more different kinds of people and help people adjust to them?
Well, I think they become a lot more efficient. And one thing that helps them become more efficient is that they have more users. So if they have more people on the site, I guess the chances are higher that they'll have someone for you specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But also they're starting to gather a lot more information, and not just in that they're asking you to answer a lot of questions. I mean, there are a lot of sites that do ask you a lot of questions, and there's some sites that, you know, that ask you very little. But sites are, you know, now increasingly watching how you behave and feeding a lot of the information about how you behave back into their algorithms.
What do you mean by how you behave? What are they watching?
So for instance, let's say that you, Ann, log on to Match and you put up, you know, a profile and you say as one of your things that you're looking for, you say, I absolutely don't like men with beards or any facial hair. I don't want to be shown any men with facial hair. I know that's something that I just don't like. And then you start to browse through all these profiles of men, assuming that you like men, and the site actually sees that you're looking at a lot of profiles of men with beards, even though you yourself may not, you know, recognize that.
Yeah.
So that's an example of how the site could see you doing something that was at odds with what you said and adjust accordingly. Say, okay, well, let's sort of de-emphasize the requirement of no facial hair because obviously it's not as important to Anne as she thinks it is. So the sites are increasingly using that way of matching to sort of enhance the efficiency of their matching.
Lori, you also founded eFlirtEngine.com to help match people not just with the right partners but with the right dating sites, which leads us to the conversation of how many dating sites are out there and why so many?
There are so many sites. There are actually 1,400 in North America, and that's a pretty old stat now, so I'd be willing to bet that that's increased since because niche dating sites is certainly a trend that's happening now, smaller communities where you can get more specific about the people that you want to connect with. And the site matters a lot because if you're on one site and your perfect match is on another, you might not meet each other. So you've got to make sure that you're in the right place. And oftentimes that may not be a site that you've ever heard of, which is why I developed eFlirt Engine.
Dan, do people just sign up with multiple sites then? Is that an option or is it too expensive or Or what are you finding?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the online daters that I interviewed a little over 100, and you did tend to meet a lot of people who would often say have one account on a free site and, you know, another on a paid site, on the theory that a free site and a paid site are going to yield slightly different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from... Go ahead, Lori.
Oh, I was going to say that's actually something I suggest as well. It's actually great to be in at least two communities, ideally one big and one niche, or one paid and one free.
I've talked to people who have found others on multiple sites and say that they kind of change their profile. They can tell it's them, but they're not the same on each site. They're slightly
different.
Yeah, and
that's okay. It's all right to be in more than one community. It's kind of like being in more than one social circle.
I have an email from Ben. He writes, I tried online dating years back. I personally felt like I was cheating, like cheating on a test type of cheating when it comes to dating. I just felt creeped out that I could scroll through a list of single women exactly how I would scroll through an online merchant. I just did not like the fact that, in essence, people were being marketed for a monthly fee. I have many friends who do use online dating, and only one relationship has come to fruit into marriage. I think the pressures of dating in person is part of the whole process of building a strong relationship. It seems online dating removes that pressure. And, Dan, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I don't think it removes the pressure. I mean, online dating is a tool. That's all it is. And if, you know, I think if you approach it with very high expectations that online dating is going to be a panacea or the cure-all to all your relationship problems, you're likely to walk away very disappointed. I mean, of course relationships need to develop offline. Of course it's just a tool. Ultimately, you need to go meet someone, and you need to engage them, and you need to build a bond. And, you know, the computer is not going to do that for you.
Lori, do you ever have to counsel people in the sense that you have to say, you're looking for something impossible, you're misunderstanding the whole point of what you're doing here?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Dan says, because I hear a lot of people say to me, well, online dating didn't work for me. But it's not a work or a not work sort of thing. It's actually just part of your journey to finding your mate, if you want to be monogamous for life. And, you know, it's part of your experience, and you have to have the experience of using this tool in today's digital society in order to really put yourself out there. Putting yourself out there doesn't just mean walking into a bar anymore.
Are you ever concerned, though, that some of your clients, and Dan, you can chirp in, are just relying on online dating and they're not getting out anymore? They're not meeting their friends. All they're doing is constantly scrolling the names in online dating site and not kind of creating more texture in their life by... You know?
Yes. Online dating is just, it's like Dan said, it's just a tool. But you need to be meeting people online and offline to really truly have a full experience, because that's how our lives are. Our lives happen face to face. And that's the most important element of a relationship.
So I mean, you can sort of impute kind of a, you know, you hear this sort of, you know, the commercial kind of shopping mall analogy a lot. This felt icky because it was like I was scrolling for books on Amazon or something like that. But, you know, and sure, if you choose to see it that way, mm-hmm. you can certainly make that analogy. But, like, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people go to bars to find people. That's like sort of an age-old way. And to me, like, that always felt kind of disgusting. You go and get drunk at a bar, and then you meet someone when you're both intoxicated because you needed this sort of social lubricant just to strike up a conversation. I mean, that to me is not the most romantic way to meet either. So it's a cultural thing. And I think the perception of online dating will probably continue to evolve into something new and something that is maybe a little bit more appealing to people.
Lori, how might your dating advice compare or contrast for someone who lives in Texas versus New York? Are there regional trends that you find for what works for people?
Absolutely. You know, someone who is in Texas versus New York, the way, you know, going back to the way your online behavior is, online behavior for people in different regions varies also. So the way that you craft your profile, the kinds of photos you post, the kinds of messages you have, and the length of those messages really varies.
And what is the biggest complaint about the online dating services? Do people complain about anything in particular that they could do better?
I think that their complaint is not a complaint that the services can fix with a click of a button. I think that the complaints come from the fact that they're still being educated on how to use the tool. And that's really part of why I did my business and why I wrote Love at First Click, because people do need education on how to think about online dating, how to approach it, because it is different. It's not something we grew up knowing, and there is an education piece that needs to happen around that.
And Dan Slater, could you talk a little bit about the variety of sites out there, not just gender or not just male, women, not just something like that, but there's sites for people who specifically don't want to get seriously involved, right?
Yeah, I mean, how much time do we have here, Anne? I mean, I wrote chapter 6 of Love in the Time of Algorithms is entitled Diaper Daddies and Lonely Stoners, and that's the chapter where I get into the world, the wonderful wide world of niche dating. I mean, it's all over the spectrum. I can give you a couple of extremes.
Yeah.
On one end, I met a woman in Southern California who was diagnosed with cervical cancer when she was very young. She was in her late 30s at the time, and she fortunately was able to beat the cancer in a relatively short period of time, but after all the treatments were over, she was no longer able to have sexual intercourse, and which, when you think about it, is a very debilitating thing when it comes to dating, obviously, because at some point you need to expose that information. And so she lived a very lonely existence for about a decade, and a couple of years ago, she finally decided to start a dating site for people like herself who, for whatever reason, were no longer able to have sex. And so that was a way that niche dating really allowed someone with a quote-unquote very thin relationship market to expand her opportunities. And that's sort of a heartwarming story.
Yeah.
On the other end of the spectrum, or at least on the other
on the
end
ones
of the
that'll make our blood run cold, yeah.
On the other end of the moral spectrum, you have sites like Ashley Madison, which was started by a gentleman up in Toronto, and it's become pretty notorious. It's a site for people who are married who want to cheat, and who want to cheat outside of the traditional venues for cheating, like the office or the local pub or whatever, and it's a way to cheat discreetly. And he has done it very, very well with that site. He has a very large membership, for better or worse. And then in between that, you have sites for, you name it, you have sites for Star Trek fans. You have sites for adults who like to dress up in diapers. You have sites for cougars and their cubs. You have sites for, sugar daddies and their sugar babies. You have sites for people who love Apple products. You have
farmers.
Sites for people who are in jail. I mean, again, you know, we'd need another hour here in the show to go through them all, but it's fairly extensive.
Are there NPR sites?
There must be. There must be an NPR
good answer.
Dating. Well, NPR should have a dating site on its site. You know, because an allegiance to NPR might indicate other sort of relationship compatibility things.
Well, thanks a lot for spending a little time on Valentine's Day talking about this, Dan Slater.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dan Slater's a journalist, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Love in the Time of Algorithms. Also, Lori Davis, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Happy Valentine's.
Thank you. Lori Davis is the founder of eFlirtExpert.com and author of Love at First Click. Moving on from meeting that right person to marrying them and sustaining that relationship when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the president's call to remake a wing of high school on German lines. Vocational training for the high-tech jobs of the future. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour 2 of All Sides, and the role and impact of America's First Ladies. That discussion from 11 till noon. Join WOSU-TV for the 20th Annual Champion of Children's Signature event Sunday afternoon at 1. Watch as former WOSU radio host Fred Anderley talks with Jeffrey Canada, the creator of the Harlem Children's Zone, a nonprofit that supports children and families. Watch the Champion of Children's Signature event Sunday afternoon at 1 on WOSU-TV. Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And support comes from Clintonville Academy, college prep education for pre-kindergarten through 8th grades. Clintonville Academy celebrates 35 years and now participates in the EdChoice program for fall of 2013. The CA Winter Open House is Sunday, February 24th from 2 to 4 p.m. Details at ClintonvilleAcademy.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. I can't get to know that it's fashion.
I can't get to know that it's fashion. Welcome back. With that Otis Redding version of Satisfaction. One in five relationships might start on the computer, but sustaining the relationship, including marriage, is as much of a struggle as ever. Although studies have shown that married people are happier than their unmarried counterparts, that happiness doesn't necessarily keep an even keel over time. Joining us now to talk about a new study that suggests a simple intervention to sustain marital, maybe not bliss, but some form of happiness, is the lead author of the study, Northwestern University social psychologist Eli Finkel. Welcome to the show, Eli.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, besides the societal cost of divorce, marriages that persist in an unhappy state also have costs.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. Scholars started to figure out that on average, people who were married were a little bit healthier, both mentally and physically, than people who were unmarried. But what's become much more interesting is over the last few decades is people have figured out that it's not just whether you're married or not, but the quality of the marriage is crucial, and being involved in a bad marriage can actually have negative effects on your mental and your physical health.
I want to get to the study, certainly, but it made me think about when you were talking about just 21 minutes a year to devote to this to enhance a marriage and save it. It made me wonder about all those divorces out there that maybe could have been saved.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't think this, you know, we have this little user-friendly procedure that seems to be surprisingly powerful at helping people sustain marital satisfaction, marital passion. I wouldn't say that it's going to save every marriage, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think there are probably some marriages that are perhaps better terminated than saved. But yes, I think what's really exciting about this new work that we've just published is that we can take marriages that are actually functioning pretty well and help them stay functioning well rather than exhibiting the typical pattern, which is a little bit of declining satisfaction over a lot of years. That's quite typical.
In your study, participating couples were assigned to write reports about their marriage three times a year. How did you settle on three times a year?
Well, you know, we weren't totally systematic on the right number, mm-hmm. but even calling them reports makes it sound, you know, fancier than it was. This is something that your listeners could do, you know, start doing today if they wanted. What happened in the study is we had 120 couples, married couples from the Chicago area, and for the first year of the study, every 4 months they wrote about, you know, the most significant conflict they'd had over the previous 4 months. And in the second year, everybody did that too, except then we randomly assigned half of the couples to do an additional writing task, right? So you're sitting there, you're by yourself, you're one of the spouses, and you're just writing into a text box on the screen. And what you're doing is you're trying to think about that conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for all involved. And what we find is, just like in other studies, in our study, it was the case that most marriages declined in satisfaction and passion a little bit over time, and that continued to be the case during the second year for the people who weren't in this additional writing task. But for people who were in this writing task, they were able to preserve their passion, their satisfaction, et cetera, over time.
In other words, they counseled themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, because these aren't the sorts of couples who end up in therapy. I mean, this is one of the, I think, big take-home messages from this work is, yeah, lots of couples go to marital therapy every year, but the generally the way people think about marital therapy is, oh my goodness, we're really on the rocks. Can we be saved or not? And I really urge basically every married person in the world to think about that a little bit differently. If you're in a marriage that's functioning pretty well, I think it's pretty reasonable to say, well, look, are there really easy things that I can do to sustain this level of marital quality over time? And so we had our couples were generally pretty satisfied at the beginning. And as I said, there's like the little drip, 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 drip. Time passes. Things aren't quite as beautiful as they were in the honeymoon period. But it looks like you can sustain that if you're a little bit proactive and do this really easy writing procedure.
It gives pause to the notion that you hear often that how marriage is really hard work.
Look, marriage is hard work. You know, that's an interesting question. So marriage is hard work. That is, a lot of us have a very naive view of marriage, right? So we're willing to spend enormous amounts of time in education or in training to learn our professional career, but then we sort of just think, oh, well, you find the right person, and then what? You get married, and that's it, right? And then it's fine. And no, it's not like that. It's not like you should be putting massive numbers of hours into perfecting your trade and then just assuming that, well, you know, marriage works, and that's fine. Yeah, it requires a bit of maintenance. But what we're learning from this new work is, if you're proactive about it, if while things are still good, you do some, you know, very minor sorts of things. I mean, this was a very easy thing. It costs no money. Mm-hmm. You might be able to sustain it. And in fact, I think you can make your marriage easy if you're willing to do some of these just basic maintenance procedures.
So how did you settle on the 120 couples? What were you? They were already in satisfactory marriages?
We didn't, 120 wasn't a magic number. We were sort of basing that on, well, how big do we think our effect size is going to be, sort of mm-hmm. more research-oriented, and also funding, right? So how much money do we have to run the study? So 120 wasn't a magic number, but what we wanted to do is make sure that we had enough couples that we could follow them for a year, see how their general trajectories of satisfaction, passion, et cetera, looked, and then in the second year have enough couples left to break them into two groups and see how these two groups differ. And they really did differ. You can sort of plot their marital satisfaction trajectory over time, and you can see there's a downward slope in the general, like, no intervention condition. And the intervention condition, that downward slope goes away. They just sort of stay happy.
My guest is social psychologist Eli Finkel from Northwestern University. He's the lead author of a study that shows the participating couples, if they write to each other. Well, it's 3 times a year, right?
Yeah, and actually, they're not even writing to each other. They're writing into a text box.
Can you give me an example, like describe a typical, if there is such a thing as a typical, series of writings?
Yeah, so what frequently happened is that once people had to adopt this third-party perspective, they were able to see the conflict not just from their own perspective, right? From their own perspective, it's easy to see everything that your spouse is doing that's so irritating and inappropriate when you're in the midst of a conflict. But from a third-party perspective, not only do you get a little bit of perspective on why what your spouse is doing might have, you know, more complex explanations than, you know, he or she's just trying to irritate you, and maybe more importantly than that, you get a little bit of a perspective on yourself and say, wow, you know, do I really sound like that? And so the writing task, it actually had three little components. The mm-hmm. first is adopt that third party perspective, and how would that person think about it? And when people wrote, they frequently wrote things that that person would realize that, you know, we were getting too caught up in the moment and that, you know, the relationship is a high quality relationship. Why are we getting so bogged down? But then in the other parts of the writing procedure, we asked them to think, okay, as you go forward over the next few months, you might face some obstacles in adopting this sort of perspective when you have conflict. What do you think those obstacles might be? And people tended to write things like, well, when I'm angry, it's hard for me to, you know, see any perspective other than my own. And then the last part of the writing procedure was, well, when you encounter those sorts of obstacles, what might you be able to do to try to overcome them? So we really had people in a very short period of time thinking through not only talking about the last conflict, but as you look forward, how can you adopt this really healthy mentality to your future conflicts?
So the writing isn't to each other.
No, it's not. Each person is writing, but no, the person will not see what you wrote. Your partner will not see what you wrote.
And when we talk about the 21 minutes, you're asking them to do this pretty quickly then?
Yep. That's right. So technically the way it worked is they did it three times over a year, so every 4 months during the second year. And there were three different writing prompts. I sort of just mentioned them. One is the third-party perspective. The second is the obstacles you might confront. And third, how might you overcome those obstacles? And they wrote for 2 to 3 minutes about each of those things. So that's about 7 minutes in total. And they did that three times over the year. And that was sufficient without spending a dollar, without leaving your house, without looking through the phone book to find an expert. All you had to do was sit and write. And there's nothing magical about the text box. You can find a pen and a piece of paper anytime you want and just try to adopt this perspective and think, as I go forward, how can I adopt this relatively more healthful way of thinking about the little disagreements we have in our marriage?
If you have a question for social psychologist Eli Finkel, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is this, did you get a sense about whether or not this was more helpful if both people in the relationship participated, or did it not matter?
It's an excellent question, and we don't know yet. So this was the very first study, and in this particular study, we started basic, and what we did is we assigned half of the couples that both members of the couple would do this writing task, and the other half of the couples, neither of the couples would do it. So what we don't know is it sufficient for one person to do the writing task, or does it have to be both of them? And that's certainly a direction for future research, and I'm excited to pursue it.
You know, there's lots of people in relationships that get married, and they never talk about their biggest disappointment in life or their greatest fear or stuff like that. They just don't have those conversations. Do we have any sense about just what talking to people, each other, about these kinds of things can do?
I think that may be a large part of what's going on. I agree with you. We tend to, I don't know if take things for granted is too strong a way of saying it, but we tend to get into habits and into routines. And I do think one of the things that this, you know, very brief writing task does is it snaps you out of that a little bit. It says, well, okay, so, you know, all marriages have some amount of challenge, some amount of conflict, right? And then there's sort of a rut. There's sort of a standard way that you get in the habit of doing that over the course of years and decades. And you can actually stop and examine that. And it doesn't, what I think you're observing is it doesn't take that much time, right? You can just say, whoa, can I step out of this mindset that I've had the whole time, step out of the rut and view things in a new and healthier way.
To what extent are you curious about whether the effects of this study or the results of this study reflect our need for some written conversation? Even when you're picking out a Valentine card, you know, there's one thing to receive one and read it, and that's nice. But for people who actually put some time into trying to pick one out or write their own, is there any value in just writing things down?
Well, I think all else equal, there is. I mean, there's a professor at University of Texas named Jamie Pennebaker who's done a lot of work showing that you know, writing about you know, something upsetting in your life, or even there's some work showing even just writing about your personal goals tends to be health promoting, right? I mean, it's like you sort of work through some of that stuff, and that's healthy. One of the reasons, though, for Valentine's Day that I think, you know, giving a card doesn't really have as much value as really writing something meaningful, mm-hmm. is the effort implied by the gift has some value. So it's certainly considerate to drop by the Hallmark store and you know, give a card to your Valentine and box of chocolates and so forth. Those are all lovely gifts. But there's no question that the more considerate, the more thoughtful the gift, the greater likelihood that you will get true enthusiastic appreciation for that gift.
And as far as the study went, this did not mean that couples who benefited from the intervention didn't argue anymore.
No, exactly. In fact, that was one of the things I found most interesting about the results, is the two groups, the people who wrote from the third-party perspective and also the people in the control condition, when they reported how frequently they had conflicts, there was no difference. When they reported how serious those conflicts were, how sort of bad the conflicts were, there was no difference. Where the difference emerged is people who had written about this third-party perspective were less angry about the same conflicts. And I think that is exactly what's driving the effect, is adopting this third-party perspective doesn't get rid of the conflict, doesn't make the conflict trivial. What it does is it makes you deal better, deal more in a more emotionally healthy way with the conflict. And ultimately, that is a big deal toward the long-term satisfaction and passion of the marriage.
And do you recommend sharing these things with each other?
I don't have an opinion on that. Uh-huh. I mean, one thing that I actually liked about the procedure that we had is that you didn't have to.
Okay.
I mean, that you could say, well, you know, what would the third party person think? Well, you know, the third party would say that my wife is being totally unreasonable or that I'm being unreasonable, and you didn't have to censor what you wrote because your partner wasn't going to see it. I think it would be a different sort of intervention, a different sort of procedure if you had to share it, but that may well have some nice value too.
And you're not sure going forward. One of the things you're curious about is whether this can do the trick over the course of many years.
Yes, we don't know. I mean, those studies are expensive, and frankly, they take a long time. If we wanted to find out, you know, what are the 10-year and 20-year consequences, the study would take at least 10 years or 20 years. So the preliminary evidence suggests that it's very good, and we literally altered the trajectories of marital satisfaction in these couples for the better. Can we sustain this over time? You know, if couples write for 7 minutes every 4 months for the rest of their marriages, all else equal, I'm sort of optimistic, but I agree that we don't know that yet.
Are you going to stay in touch with them?
I might try to follow up. Again, the results were even stronger than I realized, so
yeah.
I actually thought that study was done, but I've been excited enough about the results that I'm sort of tempted to see if I can't get in touch with a lot of them, too. It'd be interesting to do a 5-year follow-up, for example.
Well, thanks for talking about it with us today, Eli.
Sure, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Eli Finkel, social psychologist at Northwestern University and author of a new study, 21 Minutes a Year. You can learn more about it. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.